just going to work with UQSU2. So where Q is real. So then the next question is, why do we want to define loop quantum gravity with a quantum group as gauge group? So the first motivation comes from 3D gravity, where in 3D gravity, we have a spin foam model that defined with UQSU2. And this spin foam model is a model of quantum gravity for gravity for gravity with a non-vanishing cosmological constant. So then also we know that when lambda is equal to zero, at least in 3D, we know that the spin foam approach and the loop quantum gravity approach are equivalent. Okay, so but now if we want to put a non-vanishing cosmological constant into the game in loop quantum gravity, in the loop quantum gravity framework. So first, if we just look at, if we do the canonical approach, what we see is that the cosmological constant is just going to appear in the Hamiltonian constraint. So that means that a priori, the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity with the cosmological constant is going to still be built on SU2. So from this perspective, it seems very difficult to see a link between these two approaches. So I'm not going to try to answer this question because I have no clue how to answer this question. But an idea is to start with, OK, and if we start to define loop quantum gravity with UQSU2 as gauge group, then we know that in loop quantum gravity, we have nice geometric observable. So what is going to happen to this nice geometric observable if I now use this quantum group as gauge group? And are we going to be able to see a non-vanishing cosmological constant already at this level? So it's what I want. That's why I want to introduce these new tools in the context of loop quantum gravity, which are tensor operator. Yeah.
Can I suggest a reason for quantum deforming at the level of quantum gravity?
Yeah.
If the action comes from a Trent-Simons-like action, then it's not measurable on the Astrogram-Mendelsky Hilbert space because it breaks parity in CP, whereas everything which is measurable in the Astrogram-Mendelsky Hilbert space is parity even in CP. Okay. So if you want to have the action measurable in the Hilbert space, you need to deform the Hilbert space.
OK, already at the kinematical level.
So this is maybe I can even add more.
OK.
Because so the SU2 Hilbert space imposes the Gauss law, but not the Hamiltonian constraint. But the constraints algebra is just one algebra, both with the Gauss law and the Hamiltonian constraint. Yep. And people have tried to regularize the Hamiltonian constraint, like Alejandro Perez and Daniel Ponzetti, but typically they find anomalies if you do that. So it may suggest that to avoid anomalies, you have to go to UQ.
Yeah. Okay, so these are
other
motivations. To introduce a quantum group in the loop quantum gravity context, and so nice object to deal with from Sorba. So what I want to show first is that, in fact, you can even see tensor operators as natural variables for loop quantum gravity. So here, I'm just going to talk about standard loop quantum gravity defined with SU2. And for this, I'm going to recall you the spinorial formalism of loop quantum gravity. And in fact, you can see that the tensor operator really comes from this spinor variable. And then in the second part, I want to work now with a Q-deform intertwiner, Q-deform spin network. And I want to see if to this Q-deform intertwiner, I can see some discrete quantized hyperbolic geometry. So this will mean that maybe we have a cosmological constant into the game. So first, some basic about loop quantum gravity. So the starting point, you all know, I think, here is the holonomy flux algebra associated with the embedded graph in the 3D manifold. So to each link of my graph, now I have a holonomy variable, which is a SU2 group element, and a flux variable, which is a SU2 algebra element. And now at the quantum level, a basis of my kinematical Hilbert space is given by the spin network state. So a spin network is a graph plus a coloring. So a coloring is just SU2 irreducible representation associated to each edge of the graph and intertwiner associated to each vertex of the graph. So now the nice picture we have from this is that the space is discrete. So how can we see that? It's just you can build some geometric observable, such as the area and volume operator. And the action of this operator on the spin network state is diagonalized, and the eigenvalue are discrete. So in fact, you can the picture we have is that the spin network state are quantum excitation of space, where each link of my spin network carry a quanta of area, and each intertwined vertex will carry a quanta of volume. Okay. So now, in the second part, what I will do is to define spin network, but for the quantum group UQ SU2. And the first thing I would like to check is if this geometric operator still predict a discrete space. Okay. But before to do that, I want to introduce the spinorial spin network, so in formalism for loop quantum gravity. So in fact, this formalism was introduced more or less to answer this question. So most of the time in loop quantum gravity, we work with a fixed graph, so that it is we consider just a truncature of the full continuum theory. And so what are the classical degrees of freedom associated to this finite dimensional Hilbert space, where he is the number of edge of my given graph. Okay, so for this, it's very convenient to introduce some new variables. So as I told you, on each link, we have the standard variable is a holonomy and a flux variables. So that means that for each link, I have my phase space is a cotangent bundle of SU2. And in fact, this space can be obtained from a much simpler space, which is simply S2 times C2, where for each spinor, we associate the canonical Poisson bracket. That means we assume that Z is dual to its conjugate Z bar. So what is the picture that I have now? To each link, I have two spinors. So one spinor associated to the source vertex of my edge, and one spinor associated to my target vertex of my edge. Okay, and so from this variable, I can reconstruct my flux variable simply by projecting my spinor on Pauli matrix. And then the holonomy is going to be defined as a matrix which will send my source vertex spinor to my target vertex spinor. So this matrix, it's the parallel, it can be interpreted as the parallel transport. But you see that if you want that this matrix is unitary, you need to impose an additional constraint. And it's also necessary to have an additional constraint if you want to have the same number of degrees of freedom between this space and the space built from the spinor variable. So I'm going to impose what is called the area matching condition. We just impose that the two vectors have the same norm. And then by symplectic reduction, we get the same symplectic space. Okay. So now, as I told you, this formalism was introduced to to have a nice geometrical interpretation. So the geometrical interpretation is given by the twisted geometry. So a work done by Laurent and Simone Speciale. So in fact, from the spinor variable satisfying this area matching condition, you can build some new variable. So I'm going to define J as the area of my dual surface of my link, and define two different normal normalized vectors. So these two vectors are normal to my dual surface, but seen from two different frames, the frame associated to the two different vertex. So, and in fact, you need an additional variable, which is an angle, which is going to be related to the extrinsic curvature. Yeah. So now, for the moment, I just talk about one edge of a graph. So I want now to consider the full graph. So for this, I need to impose an additional constraint to each vertex. So this is going to, it's simply the closure constraint. So then what I get is that is a closed twisted geometry. And in fact, this has been recalled by Eugenio, that when you have this set of variables satisfying this constraint, you can use a very old theorem by Minkowski, which is going to tell you that a given vertex is dual to a convex polyhedron. So in fact, and where does the name twisted geometry come from, is that now the pictures that you have from your classical, your spinor network, if you want, is that in fact you have a convex polyhedron glued together along their face. So the area matching imposes that the faces have the same area, but in fact you can still have different shapes. So you have a discontinuity at each phase. And in fact, this comes from the fact that in loop quantum gravity, we have a space for torsion. So in fact, if I summarize, we started from the spinor space, then by symplectic reduction by the area matching, we get what we call twisted geometry. And then if we, once again, by symplectic reduction by the closure constraint, then we get what we call the closed twisted geometry, which are the equivalent of the of loop quantum gravity on a fixed graph. And if we want to recover, for example, Regge phase space, this can be done in the simple case of a triangulation if, we, in addition, we had a shape matching condition. So that means that in the Regge calculus, there is no place for torsion. So we have more degrees of freedom in the loop quantum gravity framework. OK, so now this was the picture given by the spinorial formalism of loop quantum gravity. So now I want to show you how tensor operators are natural. So in fact, I'm going to focus on a given vertex. So now for each vertex, each leg has a spinor and it's dual. And so if you remember that the spinor and its dual satisfies the canonical Poisson bracket, in fact, it's very natural to quantize them as harmonic oscillator. And in fact, if you just quantize Z and Z bar as a harmonic oscillator, what you get is spinor operator. So in fact, it's what I'm going to call tensor operator of rank 1 half. So more generally, tensor operator for SU2 of rank J is a operator which transform well. That means, by well, I mean which transform as the vector JM under the adjoint action of SU2. So so this is defined by these two equations, but I just want to give a more abstract definition of this tensor operator that I will use in the following. So yeah, in fact, the tensor, you can see that what I call a tensor operator is an intertwining map. That means that if I consider a map T that to a vector JM associate a matrix, so it is what I call T of JM, which is equal to this map is going to be an intertwining map if and only if I have the action of a generator, so sigma is for plus, minus, or z, acting on this matrix is equal to the matrix, where J act on the vector Jm. Okay? So, and this is simply what I wrote here by expliciting what is here I mean by adjoint action, and here I explicit the representation I'm using. Okay, so this is what I'm going to call, what I call a tensor operator of Ranke. And now I just want to give you some important property of this tensor operator to show you that, for example, we can easily recover the Schwinger-Jordan representation of SU2 or, for example, the UN formalism just using this tensor operator. So first, an important property is that the product of tensor operator is still a tensor operator. And in particular, like I can write, decompose my vector of spin 1 into the product of spin R, I can also decompose my vector operator. So what I'm going to call a vector operator is simply a tensor operator of rank 1 as the product of a spinor operator, simply using the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. And you see, so if we use explicitly the realization that we have here of my tensor operator of rank 1 half coming just from the quantization of my spinor variable, what I get is a tensor operator of rank 1, and the component of this tensor operator are the component of the SU2 generator using the Schwinger-Jordan realization, which is well known. Okay, so, and then another interesting tensor operator is going to be the tensor operator of rank 0, because usually when we want observables, that means that we want operators which are invariant under the global action of SU2. So here I can just build observable for the SU2 intertwiner space by combining my spinor operator thanks to the Clebsch-Gordan. So I'm going to, and I'm just projecting my spin on the spin 0. So again, what I get is a scalar operator. So by definition, this operator is going to be invariant under the global action of SU2. So you see that just still, once again, using the explicit definition of my one-half operator that I've defined previously, what I get is three kinds of observable for the SU2 intertwiner space. And these are exactly for people who are familiar with this formalism introduced by Etera and Laurent. They are exactly the observable of the UN formalism. So you see that they are very easily recovered. Okay, so now I'm going to generalize this to the case of a quantum group. So I'm going to consider UQSU2, so with Q real, because in fact, for the case of Q root of unity, the representation theory is a bit more complicated, so, and we don't know how to define tensor operator. So I'm going to focus on this case for the moment. So UQSU2 is a OPF algebra generated by these three generators satisfying this commutation relation. And an important aspect of the OPF algebra is the coproduct. So the coproduct encode, in fact, the action of the algebra on a two-particle system. So, for example, the coproduct of the generator will encode the total angular momentum on a two-particle system. So that means that now you see that since the coproduct is not non-commutative, that means that it's going to be important the way you are going to set up your particles. The ordering is going to be important. But in fact, two ordering can be related thanks to the what we call the R matrix. And in fact, here if I write psi is my permutation, you see that we have this nice relation, the permutation of two elements of the coproduct of the generator is related with this expression. So now another important ingredient I will need in the following is the representation theory of UQ-SU2. But it's very similar to the case of SU2. So in fact, the representation is generated by a vector, JM, and the action of the generator is similar to the one we have in the non-deformed case, just that instead of number, now we have what we call quantum number. So the definition is given here. And then before to define the tensor operator, of course, I need to define what is the adjoint action of UQSU2 on an operator. So this can be obtained thanks to the definition of the coproduct and the antipode. And so explicitly, we have that the action of the generator of UQSU2 on operator O is now given by this expression. So you see it's not non-trivial anymore. So it's not the, in the case of SU2, it was the commutator, but now it's much more complicated. So of course, computations are going to be much more complicated. Okay, so let's define now a tensor operator for UQSU2. So it's going to be the same definition as previously. So it's an operator which transforms as a vector JM under the adjoint action of UQSU2. So now we have this a bit more complicated expression which comes from the adjoint action of UQSU2. So another fundamental property of tensor operator, which is also valid to, for the non-deformed case, but I didn't mention it, is the Wigner-Eckardt theorem. So this just says that a tensor operator, the matrix element of a tensor operator, are proportional to Clebsch-Gordan. So here it's a Q-deformed Clebsch-Gordan. So where, and the proportionality coefficient is just going to be a function of the J. Okay, so then what I used in the non-deformed case was that the product of a tensor operator is still a tensor operator. So this is still going to be true. So that is that we can still easily combine two tensor operators into a third tensor operator of different rank. So it will be easy to build observables, for example. But now what is different from the case of SU2 is that now a tensor the tensor product of tensor operator it's much more complicated. So let me explain why. So now if we have T, which is a tensor operator, T tensor identity is still going to be a tensor operator. But the permutation of T tensor identity, which is so just equal to identity, is not going to be in general a tensor operator. And this comes from the fact that. Ah, okay.
Okay, I'm going to
be
okay.
Okay.
Pushing more down.
Okay. Yeah.
Or so on the side value.
Yeah. So this comes from the fact that, that my permutation psi.
People don't see.
Okay. You're right.
Okay. So what I was saying is that if we have T, which is a tensor operator, then T tensor identity is going to be a tensor operator. But in general, the permutation of is not going to be a tensor operator. So this is equal to identity tensor T, and it's not going to be tensor operator. And this comes from the fact that my permutation is not an intertwining map. So this can be seen. So here I gave the definition of an intertwining map. So that means that if, indeed, if I act with a generator, so J sigma, on, so psi, which is going to permute two vectors. So this is trivial, it's just going to permute my two vectors. You see that in general, this is not going to be equal to the permutation of the action of the generator on two vectors is going to be given by the coproduct. So it's acting on J1. And this is due to the fact that, as I already mentioned, the co-product is not co-commutative. So it's quite easy to see. So what we want to build, it's a deformed permutation that I'm going, which is going to be an intertwining map. That is that what I want to have now is psi r is equal to the permutation, the deformed permutation of this. So if you recall the nice property of my R matrices, in fact, so just that the permutation which was defined to relate two ordering of my coproduct of J. So this is equal to so it's easy to check that if we define the deformed permutation as psi r, this equality is going to be satisfied. It means that this is what we call an intertwining map. And so as a consequence, if T is a tensor operator, then we still have T tensor identity, which is going to be a tensor operator, but we're also going to have identity. Okay, so this construction is very important in the since we want to work in the intertwiner space, because the intertwiner space is really the tensor product of irreducible representation of SU2Q. So that means that we want to define the tensor product of of tensor operator. So in fact, we can generalize my construction. So if we consider, so in the case of intertwiner space, we are going to consider, for example, with n leg, we are going to have n irreducible representation of SU2. So that means that I want to, starting from, and to each of this leg, I would like to associate a tensor operator. So starting from T, I can build then for each leg, a tensor operator Ti associated so to the leg I using many times the R matrices. Okay. So now I can go to the explicit construction of tensor operator. So once again, the fundamental tensor operator for UQSU2 are going to be the tensor operator of rank 1/2, because starting from this one, you can build all the other tensor operators that you want. So once again, we are going to use as a tool the harmonic oscillator, but this time we use a Q-deform harmonic oscillator. So that means harmonic oscillator which satisfies this Q-deform commutation relation. And we also have a Jordan Finger realization of UQSU2 generators. So you see that the realization is very similar to the one for SU2. But in fact, if you can check that the commutation relation of this generator using this Q-deform commutation relation are really the one of the UQSU2 generator. Okay, and so now I can solve explicitly this equation I gave you here. So using the realization of the generators in terms of the harmonic oscillators, and for J is equal to 1/2. So then I obtain some equations, and we got only two solutions, like in the non-deformed case, T1/2 and T tilde 1/2. And you see that when Q goes to 1, we recover the tensor operator which came from the quantization of the spinor variable. Okay, so here we really have a generalization of my spinor operator for the quantum group case. So now I want to, what I'm interested in is tensor operator for the n-valent UQ. You mean define the tensor operator in terms of...
No, the alpha embed. Instead of using this...
Q deform?
Yes. Like defining alpha to be exponential n times a or something like that. And then
there is a relation.
Yeah.
So you don't have to use this fancy QM microscope.
But that's
a
nonlinear relation.
Yeah, it's nonlinear.
It's very nonlinear. It's a relation between these alphas and.
Yeah, like alpha is exponential n a.
There is a relation between this QD-form oscillator and the normal one, but yeah. It's non-linear, so then to use them, it's not, I don't see how it will simplify. Because here you see that, for example, at least for the realization of the generator, we obtain very simple expression.
Just to know the representation. I mean, how do you? The other question is, forget about that. How do you represent it? What's the fuck representation of the?
But so there is
a.
We can make the link between the representation of UQSU2 and some number vector for defining for the harmonic oscillator. In fact, it's even the same link between. You still have a is equal to j a.
Bigger.
Sorry?
Larger.
Bigger. Big.
And a is equal to j a plus b divided by 2. So we still have a realization of Fock space and a clear link between the representation of QQSU2 and the basis of this QD-form harmonic oscillator.
Yeah, there is a default Fock space for the.
Yeah.
So what is A on N? Is
so DP is the same with the bucket, with the Q number.
Okay. Yeah, so then the action of. Usually we see the action of the creation operator as a derivative, so then now it's a deformed derivative, but it's still defined. Yeah, so now I want to go to the intertwiner space. So I consider n-valent intertwiner. So that is a vertex with n leg. And from the building block, which are my T1 half spinor, I can build two n spinor operator for associated to each leg. Okay. So but now be careful, contrary to the non-deform case, you see that two different spinors associated to two different legs will not commute in general, which was not the case in the non-deform case. And now, once again, I can define some observable for the intertwiner, just combining my T1 half operator thanks to Q-deform Clebsch-Gordan. So I project my spin on the spin zero, and I get tensor operator of rank zero. So by definition, they are invariant under the global action of UQSU2. And once again, we get three kinds of observables. And in the Q limit, what we get is the E, F dagger, and F observable, which appear in the standard UN formalism. So a nice result of the standard of the UN formalism is that the E observable form a UN algebra, and that the intertwiner space carries an irreducible representation of UN. So now the natural question is, what is do we have a kind of UQ UN structure associated to the Q deform intertwiner? So we don't have the full answer for the moment, but at least we know that we can rewrite our E operator as function of the UQN generator. So here my straight E variable are the UQN generator. So we have an explicit formula for the EIJ in terms of the generator of UQN. So then also, I remind you that in the In loop quantum gravity, all observables are built from the flux are built from the flux variable, and the flux variable are quantized as more or less as a SU2 generator. And in fact, this can be done because, as I already mentioned it, the SU2 generator are vector operator, tensor operator of rank one. So now, if we want to have the generalization of the quantized flux variable in the quantum case, we need to define our vector operator. So this can also be done by combining the spinor operator thanks to Clebsch-Gordan. So then, explicitly for UQSU2, you see that our vector operator are now also a function of the generator of SU2, of UQSU2, but the components are not the component of the generator of UQSU2. So that means that we cannot use the generator of UQSU2 as variables to build observables. They do not transform well, and so we cannot use them to build observable. Okay, they do not transform as vector. But in fact, when you go to the limit Q goes to one, then you recover the result that the tensor, the vector operator is the SU2 generator. So now for the inter. Yeah, but this.
Which preserves the algebra. So.
No, it's not preserved.
No, the Q action, the adjunct action, you know, S, and then you multiply by, you just make a twist of the unit.
And this is what does preserve. If you look at the. So normally the adjunct action of J plus on J plus is equal to zero. And for example,
there's a Q different action. Like
yeah, I know.
It's on the left, and then you multiply.
Yeah,
it
just, it's just the adjunct action I gave you, because the adjunct action is defined here, is defined using the co-product and the antipode. So here, the adjunct action J plus is J plus, then the operator times S Q. So it's really the action you are talking about, the adjunct action. But you can check that the SU2Q generator are not transforming as a vector. So for example, you would be expecting that the action of J plus on J plus is equal to zero, but it's not the case here, for example.
Maybe, but no, it's not here, but it doesn't. The adjunct action is a morphism of the algebra. The Q action, there's a notion of Q action, which is a morphism of the algebra in the QSU2. So,
and that's it's not going to be this adjunct action, because
there's a generalization. You take
delta
and then you take one times the antipode, and then this one preserves the algebra.
But not when we do the calculation for UQ, but not. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
You mean the group does not act on the algebra?
No, but it
preserves,
but it's just that the action is not.
It doesn't simplify.
I think you don't put the antipodes there, so maybe.
Yeah, we put the antipodes. We define the
adjunct
action with the
antipodes. But for sure, what transforms a vector is not the generators. Generators are not transforming like vectors, so they are not rank one operators. That's
maybe your action
is there some other. Maybe there's
another
combination of some other.
No, for example, if you look at the action of J plus on on itself. So this is the adjunct action defined using the co-product and the antipode. So in the case Q equal one, you find that this is equal to zero. But here is going to be proportional to something on J plus and some Q factor.
Maybe, but the algebra is preserved.
But it's just that.
The algebra, that it's a morphism of the algebra.
But it just that it doesn't transform as you are expecting.
Well, you transform as it transforms.
Here we don't mind something that transforms like a vector, right? You want to have stuff that transforms like a scalar, something that transforms like a spinor, so that you can combine stuff and not so that basically stable under the joint action. You don't want to have stuff that transforms like crazy. You want to have stuff that transforms well. Right? You want to have like something that is a scalar on the other, the transformation of UQ as U2. Like J plus is not basically going to be a component of a vector. So if you take J plus and J minus and JZ, you combine them, you're not going to get something that is invariant to the UQ as U2.
Well, that's, I think it's a too strong thing. This maybe you want, yeah. There's different.
It's going to be combine.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is not in contradiction with what I said. It's just that what I want is something stronger than just.
You want something else. You don't care about the algebra there. You care about the linear structures.
Yeah.
So the algebra is destroyed here.
Yeah. It's,
whereas
it's
whereas in the other one,
yeah.
You care about the algebra.
That's fine. Yeah.
Here you don't care about the algebra. So it's a different emphasis.
But actually, we tend in some early papers actually use those guys to define this deformation of the universe. We use these guys, these vector operators.
Yeah, since you can
write
vector
operators
as a function of the generator, you can define new generator and do algebra. In fact, it's what happened, for example, for the E observable we define that are not forming really. UQN algebra because they don't satisfy the UQN commutation relation, but you can still write them in terms of the UQN observable. So it's the UQN generator. So it's where you define another structure. Then of course, if you want to have a coproduct and anything, it's
okay,
more complicated.
That's good, that's good. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now
on this point, I'm not sure if it's an important point, but so the algebra provides a representation of this group, this pseudo, this quantum
group. You have to find nonlinear functions and generators,
mm-hmm.
And these nonlinear functions and generators will transform well.
Well, never mind how they transform, but the algebra itself, does it provide a representation of this?
Of
this quantum group? And if so,
you would say
it does not.
No, yes, it does. But we're doing. There's an action which is the
algebra
action that preserves the algebra.
That's what you were saying. Now,
this action is not the one they like.
But I'm just wondering, then can you reduce it into irreducible representations and say what they are?
So when you use those variables, you know what are the representations.
Because
transform exactly like representations.
Yeah, so you know how to decompose as irreducible. And then for the other.
So are they part of, are they a sub representation of this adjoint representation?
Shouldn't have a sub representation.
Sorry?
It shouldn't have. The adjoint is irreducible.
You say it's irreducible, the adjoint representation?
Yeah, so the adjoint action is basically, so here it's going to be.
So it's just some. So it's some new irreducible representation. That is not the vector representation.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yes.
So is there like a classification of all the representations?
But then I don't know.
Like,
so Laurent is saying that there is an action, and the adjoint action that it is leaves stable the algebra. Okay, so this means that this adjoint action can be probably rewritten as a sum of.
Maybe.
But you just said it was irreducible. But I thought you just said it was irreducible.
No,
this adjoint action.
No, this one is not, we don't know.
Yeah, it's not clear. In the commutative, I mean, in the Q equal to 1, everything's fine. That's a vector.
There it's irreducible and it's a vector.
Yes. And in this case, you have to rename the generators, don't transform like vectors. You have to find a nonlinear function of those generators so that they basically transform like vectors. That's what we said.
But do you have a classification of all the irreducible representations
mm-hmm.
in this case?
Yes.
So in principle, you could decompose this adjoint representation into the
mm-hmm.
irreducibles.
Yes.
Yeah.
One could ask which ones. That would sort of answer your question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So now we can do the same for the entrepreneur. So I'm using the same program as here, but instead of now I'm using Ti, so it's the I defined for the leg I, so I get for each leg now I get the vector operator. Okay. So naively, I can then define what will be called the area operator and volume operator. So in the classical case, you know that the area operator is just given by the norm. The area squared is the norm squared of J, of the SU2 generator. So now I'm just generalizing this formula. So instead of, since I said that the SU2 generator were vector operator, I generalize this formula with vector operator for UQSU2. So it's my T1 now. So T1 scalar T1. When I said scalar, now it's just that I'm forming invariant vector, invariant operator, thanks once again to the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Okay, and the same thing, I can generalize what would be called a volume operator. So here, when I denote this by the wedge product, it's just that taking two tons vector operator, I'm forming another vector operator. So that means that I'm using the Clebsch-Gordan 1-1-1, C111. Okay, so now let's get more precise and go to the case of 2+1 loop quantum gravity. So with the gauge group, now I'm working with the gauge group UQSU2, and the question is going are we going to see a non-vanishing cosmological constant? So now the space is a 2D manifold, and for simplicity, I'm going to consider a triangulated 2D manifold. So now the basis of my kinematical Hilbert space is going to be spin network with three valent UQ2 SU2 intertwiner. So I'm going first to define what are going to be this intertwiner. So I decompose my what I want to be an intertwiner on this vector space. And in fact, so I want this to be an intertwiner, I mean an invariant vector. So I want that the action of SU2Q on this vector is equal to zero. So for this, I need to use twice the coproduct to define this action. And what I get is a recursion relation on this coefficient. And this recursion relation is exactly the recursion relation defining the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, the Q-deform Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. That means that if, in addition, I impose that my intertwiner is normalized, my intertwiner is defined uniquely by Q-deform Clebsch-Gordan. So this is similar to what we have in the non-deform case. And so now the question is, what is the geometry associated to this three-valent intertwiner? So I need to be a bit more precise now. So I said that Q was real. So I'm going to write Q as exponential of lambda, where lambda is going to be the ratio of LP being the Planck length, and R being the cosmological radius. Or if you prefer, I can write LP times square root of the cosmological constant, where once again, since we want lambda real, this means that the cosmological constant has to be positive in our case. You mean if we...
There is for lambda positive, you get Q, you know, I, because it's the usual root of unity.
Yeah, but I'm not working with a...
Yeah, so but the formula for taking the physics is...
Ah, you mean...
Mean Q really is lambda negative, not lambda positive. It's hyperbolic geometry, not spherical geometry.
Yeah, it's what we are going to get is hyperbolic geometry.
So lambda negative.
Yeah.
But you mean the convention, you're using the opposite convention.
Yeah, it's even on the convention of the...
Oh, whether it's hyperbolic or spherical,
no. The hyperbolic and spherical...
Lambda positive is spherical.
Normal.
Convention, right? I mean, I'm using that convention. Positive lambda is very close, negative lambda is ADS.
Okay.
It's okay, just.
Nothing
for that. Lambda is negative. You know.
Yeah. Wow. So, what is important is that Q is wrong.
Yeah. But lambda negative. Now, it's also physical, it's important to know which case you're looking at. You know, positive lambda is very different from negative.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so I thought it was. Okay, thanks for the.
But if Q has to be real, is there some deep reason why Q has to be real?
Yeah, Yeah, it's just that for, so all this formalism is built on what I call the tensor operator, and we don't know how to define tensor operator for pure root of unity. But then the representation theory of SU2 is Q root of unity, is not as simple. For example, if you have two, if you want to decompose the tensor product of two representations, you still have indecomposable representation. So since we are really using this, we do not know how to define. And I haven't seen in the literature tensor operator defined for Q root of unity. So that's why.
But if you forget that, then you just will know the formula zero, you're not seeing any problem.
Sorry?
No?
What did you?
If you just take the, all the formulas we have and then you know, put Q unity but and truncate the sums to smaller than n, you will not see any inconsistencies. It's a recipe. Now, whether it's a full mathematical theory that takes care of this indecomposable,
But at least the mathematical objects, which are the tensor operator, are not well defined in the Q root of unity. So maybe
you can define T1 half and then multiply T1 and T2 up to Tn.
Yeah,
right?
for this, since we are using T1 half, I guess we can do it. But it's just that for J, arbitrary J.
No, for J,
but it doesn't exist. It's
more than
arbitrary.
Yeah, but if it was so simple, I mean, you would basically, a root of unity would be just you take SU2 and you cut, we put a cut over, that's not true. I mean, the mathematical theory is different, the representation theory is different. How are you going to represent things? How are you going to really act
all
the operators and representations?
All the formulas you wrote, there are more representations which are trans zero, but you don't see them in spin network. So, but for all the representations are smaller than the color.
Yeah, but if you represent things, what?
I'm just asking what's wrong if you take the nice rule. I know the mathematical. That if you don't trace, then you have to be better.
So,
but I know also that in practice, all these mathematical details, as soon as you take trace, they all disappear. So you don't see them anymore.
No.
So I'm just saying. You know, I mean, for the physicists.
You're right, but since we started from objects who were defined only for, at least in books and stuff, only for Q. Real, for the moment we focus on Q real, but maybe in the physical context we can just say, okay, Q can be also the root of unity, and then for the mathematics we don't care, and we see what happens. I don't know. So, but for the moment, so Q is real and everything is well defined. And now I want to define some observables, so I'm going to start with what I call the length and angle observable. So in the case Q equal 1, you know that the square of the length will be given by J scalar J, and this is just given by the action on an intertwiner. Is very simple, it's just the Casimir. So now I want to generalize this formula. So as I said, I'm going to generalize the J variable at our T1 tensor operator, and what I get now, so the scalar product now is what I call scalar product is when I combine with some Clebsch-Gordan projecting on the zero spin, and what I get is a function of J plus 1 half, or more precisely it's proportional to this hyperbolic sine square of J plus 1 half times lambda. So a proposition for the quantized length is going to be J plus 1 half times LP, and I will go back to this proposition in the next slide. So now we can also define angle observable. So this, in the case Q equal 1, we just get, so it's just the scalar product, this will be given by the scalar product of J on B, scalar J on C. And so this has been computed very recently by Valentin and Laurent in their paper. So you get just this simple expression in terms of the spin. And if we generalize this formula to the quantum group case, once again, now we consider the vector operator associated to the edge B and the vector operator associated to the edge C of my spin network. So now I have three valent spin network with so A, B, and C. Okay. So Now, what are the interpretation of these two previous formula? So in the case Q equal 1, in fact, if you divide by the normalization of the J, which is a, just so the square root of the Casimir, what you get is a cosine operator, and this action on the intertwiner is just, in fact, a quantized version of the cosine law, where the angle that I'm considering is the angle between, so in fact, we can say that our intertwiner is dual to a triangle, and so what I'm when I quantize the norm are quantized by the SU2 generator, and so here the angle that I'm considering is the angle between the tangent vector associated to the edge of my triangle. So now let's go to the case Q different of one. So once again, I'm dividing by the norm of my tensor operator of rank one, which is the hyperbolic sine of this. And what I get is this operator, which acts diagonally on the Q deform intertwiner. And I get this expression in terms of hyperbolic cosine and hyperbolic sine. And this, in fact, you can interpret this as a quantized if we use the proposition we did for the quantized length, which was just that J plus 1/2 times LP, what we get is that we obtain a quantized version of the hyperbolic cosine law. So that means that now my intertwiner could be considered as dual to a hyperbolic triangle. Well, so for simplicity, I have put the A at the original of my hyperboloid, and now B and C are obtained by AB and AC are geodesic on my hyperboloid. And so now the angle I'm considering is the angle between the tangent vector. So this tangent vector belongs to this plane tangent to the point A, and there are the tangent to the geodesic AB and AC. So what I got is really the so it's a way to define the cosine of this angle, and we get so a quantized version of the hyperbolic cosine law. So in fact, this seems to say that if we consider intertwiner defined with intertwiner for UQ SU2, what we get is the geometry associated to this intertwiner seems to be hyperbolic. And well, here I forgot to precise that R is a hyperbolic radius, and in our case, is going to be related to lambda, which is related to the cosmological constant. Okay, so now one question could be, do we have a minimum angle? So you see that in the case, non-deform case, if you put in this formula, GA is equal to first to zero, that is, you consider the generated triangle, or more precisely, the very simple intertwiner. What you get is that this expression is equal to, and JB is equal to JC, because you want to have a simple intertwiner. So, and what you get is just the cosine is equal to one. But you can see that this is not the case anymore in this formula. So this seems to indicate that indeed in the case with hyperbolic geometry, you get a minimum angle. So I'm going to finish just say some word on another nice observable to define in 2 plus 1 LQG, which would be the area observable. So for hyperbolic triangle, I just recall you the classical formula, which is given by pi minus the sum of the angle times so r square. And so a proposition, once again, we can do a proposition for this area observable, which as in the quantum, in the classical case, you define your area observable, the square of the area observable as TA wedge TB. And you take the norm of this vector acting on the intertwiner. We can do the generalization of this formula acting on the Q deform intertwiner. And what we are expecting, of course, is not really the area, but a function of the area. And so we have some results. So it's that first the observable is going to be diagonalized by the spin network basis, and that the quantization, well, we still have to check some factor, but the quantization seems to be, this formula seems to be the quantization of the classical formula for sine of the area. So I'm going to conclude now. So what I show is that in the SU2 case, tensor operators are quite natural objects in the loop quantum gravity context, because they come from, in fact, just the quantized spinor variable if we start from the spinorial formalism. And from this tensor operator, it's very easy then to recover the UN observable for the UN observable for the UN formalism. Thanks. And another important point is that the tensor operator are really the building blocks to build observables for any gauge group or classical or quantum. Because once you know this object, you just know that to get observable, you need to combine them thanks to Clebsch-Gordant to project on the spin zero variable. And then when we show in the quantum group case is that we define first observable for, it's possible to define observable for a QD-form intertwiner. And this is the first hint that the geometry associated to this intertwiner is hyperbolic. So this could be maybe related, but this can be related to a presence of a non-vanishing cosmological constant. And so, of course, there's still a lot of work to do, and some of this work is in progress. So first, for example, for the UQ-UN structure of the QD-form intertwiner, we still have to precise some details. And another idea would be to, for example, generalize the Hamiltonian introduced by Valentin Aedera, which was already a generalization of the Hamiltonian introduced by Valentin and Laurent. So it's just the one written in terms of the spinor variable to the QD-form case. And maybe this will allow us to make a first link between an Hamiltonian constraint and hopefully the SIGG symbol for UQSU2. And if we have this link, that means that for the first time, we could have a link between spin foam model defined with UQSU2 and a loop quantum gravity approach. And then the next point, which is we are working on with Valentin, is try to understand what is the classical phase space associated to this tensor operator. So that means what more or less is the equivalent of the spinor variable. But so we have seen that in the classical case, the spinor variable are quantized as tensor operator. So now we have the tensor operator is a QD-form case. So what are the equivalent of this spinor variable? Okay, thanks for your attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you expect that there's a generalization of the Minkowski theorem for polyhedra on hyperbolic spaces and similar quantum version for the quantum group with quantum interfinders?
So first we have to define the equivalent more or less of the twisted geometry variables. Since we see that for the 2 plus 1 case, an intertwiner seems to be dual to hyperbolic triangle, then it would be nice to have in the Frodi case that the picture now is a polyhedron with a curvature on the faces, and put that group together.
The Minkowski theorem doesn't require LQG.
It's a question already at the level of classical geometry.
So does it extend to homogeneously curved geometries?
I don't know when you start, but could be.
That's the question.
It's before LQG.
If there's a generalization on the classical level, at the level of classical geometry, then there may be also quantum version of this.
Yes, and
Yeah, if we have, I think if we have the classical version, then...
Just apply that.
Yeah.
Just study the face to face.
So I have a question. Is this there any way to argue that there would be a preferred value for Q and that for the cosmological constant?
There's a one, what's the question?
Well, basically, if there's a way to solve the cosmological constant problem because there would be some kind of preferred value for Q.
No, I don't think that with this approach we could, because here we really consider Q as a parameter as J, so then as a G, so yeah, I don't think we can, yeah, because since it's really like a parameter, yeah, we don't have anything to predict something about the cosmological constant. Yeah.
So this is an advantage in the case where you let yourself go to a root of unity and you find out that the inverse cosmological constant is quantized in terms of an integer. But only that...
It's for pure root of unity?
Does that hold also transient integer?
I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah.
So, I'm just saying that the argument is mentioned works in 3D in Euclidean signature.
I was thinking in 3 plus 1, where the group is SU2.
Okay. So
there you can argue that the group is compact, so you should be able to root of unity.
Yeah.
I mean, the argument is just that the group of symmetries is compact. And usually when it's compact, the couplings can have integral values.
Yeah.
So if I understand right, all this structure is associated with fixed graphs.
Yeah.
So with fixed graphs. But loop quantum gravity starts from quantization of the theory of the connection where the graph sampled the anatomies of the connection and so loop is a whole Hilbert space structure.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea about how to build up the whole Hilbert space structure from these structures in fixed graphs?
So our first idea was try to generalize a spinorial framework, so it's to this case of quantum group, so it's for a fixed graph. Then I don't know if we can do the, because to get the spinorial formalism, we start from the holodomy flux variable, and we find, so I don't know if we can go the way around.
I remember Hanno had some arguments when he came last time.
Yes.
So you still smear the connection to get holonomies, but you do something quite different with the fluxes. You try to exponentiate them.
So now, we would expect, if we are working on the hyperbolic case, that our flux variable are boost variables and instead of the flux variable. Or in the spherical case, are just group elements. So now the point, because it's a way to see a point on the hyperbolic surface or spherical surface. So yeah, it would be more that instead. So we could the idea would maybe to first try to keep the holonomy variable, and instead of the flux variable, to have either group element in the case or boost in the hyperbolic case.
So is that the same thing as, I mean, another way you could approach the whole problem is to try to generalize the notion of a connection to a connection valued in a quantum group rather than the algebra.
Yeah.
Oh,
you mean that?
I mean, you might just start just with that question, is there a notion of a connection valued in the quantum group rather than the algebra?
So, and then try to quantize the.
Because the quantum group comes from quantization, so the classical level, everything should be classical. to be a usual combination. The quantum group will appear because h bar is not zero. H bar is
here is the kind here it's the value of the cut margin.
No, here it's the ratio of LP over the cosmological scale. So if you put LP to zero, the value is zero.
Okay.
Q is the ratio still, between the
that's a physics it's a physics question. So for once I'm asking a mathematics question.
Yeah, no, there's a physics question, but it's not going to be the quantum group should come from the polarization. The challenge is that whatever you do, the quantum group should not be put there. It comes from the polarization. It comes when you turn on H bar. It's not there at the classical field. That's why we don't see.
As a classical field theory, just classically as you do. But when you quantize, you get the quantum.
Okay, so the answer to my question is just no. There is no interesting mathematical structure of the connection valued in.
Well, there may be, but for physical reason, I don't think we want.
Watching in something like what you do in lattice case theory.
No, but that could be,
because there's no infinitism.
No, but that could be the quantum connection. I mean, here, if you look at the quantum holonomy in the quantum case, quantum holonomy is going to be a 2Q, right? A group element in a quantum group element.
Yeah, but there's no such thing as a quantum group element. So
quantum group is not a quantum. It's not a group.
I mean, what you have is the functions on the quantum group which are operators, but there's no such thing as a quantum group as an object which is a group element. But, so except the R matrix, if you want, but it lives in two tensor to algebra. So
okay, so that's the mathematical answer. The mathematical answer is the quantum group is a group. So there's no notion of one value in the quantum group.
There's no point. Quantum groups have no functions of quantum group exist. Quantum groups. There's no such object as a.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
Yeah, but just a quick comment. But nevertheless, like Mikey was saying, the phase space structure should be affected. The phase space is going to be different.
The phase space.
Yes. Okay.
This is
for
sure.
It's what we. Yeah.
But then, when you quantize, boom.
So it's only the flux operator which is the form.
It does function.
Yeah, but at least
But hopefully, because at classical level, you want the usual classical structure. You want all this structure to this weird. Why do you want the other way? You want this quantum weirdness to appear because of quantization, not because you put it by hand. At the classical level, it's usual GR, right? So this weirdness comes when you put H bar in zero. That's the beauty of it, but nobody has demonstrated it, really.
Sure.
One final question.
Go ahead.
That's a completely different, probably wild suggestion. So if I understand, a lot of the motivation of this is to incorporate a non-zero cosmological constant. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, at least it was the initial. But you never motivated.
So I'm just wondering about another approach. I mean, as we know in the classical theory, if you formulate it in the so-called unimodular way, then the cosmological constant is a free constant of integration. It's not actually built into the fundamental theory Lagrangian at all. So I'm just wondering, could you follow an approach like that? I mean, I'm not sure if it would have to do with this, but could you reformulate your LQG or whatever the starting point is in a unimodular way somehow, that maybe it's spin foams, and then would a cosmological constant pop out automatically as some sort of integration constant?
I don't know if this has been done. I think we've been looking at unimodular.
There's a version of the unimodular gravity written in terms of the Lebesgue action. Mm-hmm. You can quantize it formally in terms of the path integral, but not to my knowledge, the spin foam formalism wasn't working.
It's not working. Because you might hope then it would sort of unify the different values of the cosmological constant in one formula.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I want to come back to this issue of rooted unity, because there's another kind of argument in three, and this holds in 3+1, not in 2+1, to expect that the rooted unity case is the physical case, and that's it's indirect, it's the holographic idea. And the idea is that if De Sitter space-time has an entropy, which is a finite entropy, proportional to I think 3/(this). Is it the square root of the cosmological constant? 3/ the cosmological constant. Then supposing that there's a Hilbert space associated with the physics in such a space with a finite entropy, then and you observe in it and you rotate, then you need a finite dimensional representation in another rotation group, which could transform the states in this finite dimensional Hilbert space because you have a finite entropy. And if you require that the dimension of the Hilbert space match the entropy from the De Sitter space-time, the semi-classical entropy, and that you put a cap on the representations associated with having a quantum deformation of root of unity, you pull out exactly the relationship between the cosmological constant and the Q deformation parameter that you get by other means. So there's this idea that having the quantization of the group at a root of unity imposes a kind of infrared cutoff, which makes the physics in De Sitter space time finite.
Okay, so for you, the physical case would be to work with the Q root of unity?
Yes, in 3+1.
So as I said, what we used, at least in the book, in the mathematical level, the contour bars are just well defined for Curiel, but maybe as Laurent suggested, since...
I mean, you didn't use any fancy mathematics here. You have this one-half operator and you multiply it, so just do it. The one-half operator is defined for Curiel. And at the end of the day, you get formulas that depend on Q. These formulas are rational functions of Q, so they are analytic. So you just can continue them everywhere you like. Nowhere there's going to be. You know, the only thing that happens when you have root of unity is that you might have poles in these rational functions situated there. But if the spins are smaller than what, you're never going to see these poles. And sometimes you have zeros, that is, you know, derivative to zero. So that's not it. In what you did, you need is the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient and they are the same.
Yeah, the combinatorics with the Clebsch-Gordan is fine, but then you have to represent things, so you have to use like harmonic oscillators and stuff like that.
Yeah, take the harmonic oscillators.
I don't know if things are going to work so fine.
For the harmonic oscillators, you need the harmonic oscillator dimension is finite dimensional. So all you need is, yeah.
Because now if Q is not real, for example, we define the generator K by Q, JZ, and so now if Q is not real, it's not Hermitian anymore. So we have to.
So it's all finite dimensional.
But for the representation,
maybe you can finish the discussion passing. Yeah. Okay, let's thank our speaker. Yeah.